Case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the third case, Johnson versus Myers. Mr. Kelly. Mr. Kelly.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Terry Kelly. I represent the plaintiff, appellant William Johnson. We're here on a review of a grant of summary judgment by District Court McDade regarding a deliberate indifference Section 1983 cause of action. My client was a pretrial detainee at Woodford County Jail, and while there fell and fractured his calcaneus of his ankle. During the ensuing approximate 2.5 weeks, he received what we allege to be care that was so substandard that it rose to the level of deliberate indifference. And specifically, the particular period of time which we're concerned here in terms of when the deliberate indifference conduct occurred was after the ankle was casted by an outside orthopedic surgeon. After that occurred, it is undisputed in the record that my client sustained an increase of symptoms. The cast was too tight. He complained about the cast immediately causing problems with his foot. That is undisputed. In fact, that's one of the defendants stated undisputed facts in their statement of facts supporting their motion for summary judgment. So that's an undisputed fact. The question here is whether or not the county defendants, the jailers and the sheriff, appropriately responded to that undisputed fact as to a problem with the cast. Judge McDade, rendering summary judgment before actually even receiving a reply brief from the defendant, ruled as a matter of law that number one, the injury was one with which the defendant did not have knowledge of its substantial serious nature, and number two, that they had taken appropriate action as a matter of law.
Well, what evidence is there in the record that the deputies knew of a newer increased risk of serious injury following the application of the cast?
Well, there's no dispute that they were aware that Mr. Johnson had increased complaints of pain with his cast.
Right.
He complained that it was tight. He complained that it was essentially killing him and he needed to have medical care immediately. So that's undisputed. The question or not is what...
May I ask my question?
Thanks.
Wouldn't a lay person expect there to be increased discomfort after the application of a cast?
I think
we're talking about lay people here.
I agree with you, and I would think as lay people we'd think just the opposite. In other words, once you have a cast applied to a broken extremity, the idea is to eliminate the symptoms of pain and discomfort. I would ask you, if your child came home, a young child came home with a fractured arm and you took it to the doctor to have it casted, and the child came home and said, "This cast is killing me," and not just right after it's applied, but the night that it's applied, the day after it's applied, and for 7 subsequent days continues to cry in excruciating pain that the cast is killing me, any responsible parent would take that child to the doctor and say, "Something is wrong with this cast," and they wouldn't wait 7 days to do it. That's no different than here when we have someone... You look like you're ready. There's no difference than here where we have someone who is complaining of excruciating pain, which is undisputed, caused by this cast, and it goes ignored. Now, the standard on whether or not the deputies had a subjective awareness of the seriousness of the condition is one that can be proved on the basis of circumstantial evidence alone, in fact, on the basis of subjective complaints alone. This court has held as much, and it has held as much repeatedly, that it's enough that the inmate or prisoner complains of excruciating, increased complaints of pain, that that puts the defendants, the correctional officers who have charge of this individual, that there's a problem that needs to be addressed.
Now, following up, Ms. Kelly, on your parent-child analogy, don't we have deputies here, lay deputies, seeking professional help from Dr. Cohen?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Don't we have lay deputies seeking help after the complaint from Dr. Cohen?
Now, remember, this is summary judgment, and the question is, do we or don't we? We have 11 deputy defendants. The only evidence we have of any seeking of medical care after the complaint occurred are from two of those 11. Other than those two, we have no evidence whatsoever that these deputies that saw this individual day in and day out for 8 days did anything. So let's just...
Well, we wouldn't need all 11 to call, would we?
Well,
I mean, the evidence
that I would suggest if no one's calling, we need someone to call. We need someone to call not just once, but until it's addressed. But the point is this. We have a classic factual question as to whether or not there was ever a call made. We had two individuals, and this is the classic mistake that Judge McDade did on a motion for summary judgment. And remember, he's to determine whether or not there is a factual issue for a jury to determine, not to resolve that factual issue. And I would submit respectfully.
Where's the contest on whether they called or not?
We have two.
Well, nobody's saying they didn't call, right?
Well, I disagree with that. The doctor was very equivocal.
The doctor says he doesn't recall, right?
I'm sorry?
The doctor says he could have called, or he doesn't recall or something.
He has no specific recollection that they called. When asked hypothetically, I want you to assume they did call and complained about the cast, and that's important because the defendant tries to bring in other testimony about assume they called and made general complaints, to which he said, well, they probably did. But when the question was put to him, I want you to assume that they called and complained about the cast, he emphatically responded, well, do you have facts that existed? I don't recall it existing, and I'm not comfortable answering that question unless you can show me it did exist. And we said, well, you have to answer the question because, as we know, they're required to under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And he said it would be supposition for me to answer that. In other words, he is not conceding that they did. And then the next question, which he responded, when he finally answered the hypothetical, he said, if I had received that call, as any medical doctor would have to concede, I would have referred them to the orthopedic surgeon who put that cast on because obviously we have a problem here. Did that happen in this case? No. So we have a situation where it's very classic. This happens often in cases where someone says, I don't remember it happening, but if it had, I would have taken certain activity. I did not take that activity in this case. Ergo, we can assume it would be a reasonable inference for the jury to make that they never received that call. You put that in the context of the equivocal nature of the sheriff's testimony that they actually did call the doctor. They said, I don't recall. Well, maybe I did. I think it was after the cast was applied. Yeah, I think so. So we have equivocal testimony that way. We don't have any verification from any written documents where verification existed previously. Remember, we're reviewing this on the basis of whether or not a reasonable jury could conclude no call was ever made. And I would submit to you this is a classic example of where the jury has to resolve this most crucial issue in the case. And I, in fact, point out in my brief about how crucial this is, because we had alternative claims against the county jail defendants and a medical malpractice claim against Dr. Coleman, the contracted medical provider. And the claims are not entirely, but to some extent, mutually exclusive in the sense that the sheriff's deputies are at fault if they didn't contact the doctor. The doctor's at fault if they did contact him and he didn't do what was professionally negligent or professionally required at that time, and that is to make sure the cast problem with the cast is addressed. What McDade did in this case was essentially set rule as a matter of law.
Well, who did?
I'm sorry?
Who did?
Judge McDade. What Judge McDade did in this case is ruled as a matter of law that what I'm going to accept the sheriff's testimony is true that they did make the call. He dismissed for want of jurisdiction the the medical the state medical malpractice claim against Dr. Conan, so now I have to proceed in state court against him, in which case there's no binding effect of this grant of summary judgment against a non-party. And so we have a situation where we've already had a finding that the call was made and the basis for summary judgment is granted on the basis that call was made against one of the defendants. But now another defendant can come in and say, that call wasn't made to me, because if it was, I would have sought professional, I would have done the appropriate medical thing by addressing the problem with the cap. So it places us in a great deal of dilemma. That's why you have both claims heard in the same court of law, and that's why you have a finding of whether or not that crucial fact, i.e. seeking medical care for the problem with that cap, determined by the fact finder as against one or the other defendant.
Ms. Kelly, would the record reflect whether or not Mr. Johnson could have received the Tylenol just on the basis of requesting it and the guards giving it to him?
Absolutely. The record is replete with that, and I go through it at length in my brief. The deputies themselves said, we dispense Tylenol to anybody who asked for it, regardless of why they asked for it. In fact, one of them even referred to it in response to my question, that it was like prison camping. I mean, I didn't make up that term. That came out of the discovery in the case. They want to rely. In fact, that's the only thing they can point to, the defendants can point to, as to what they did during this 8 days where we have inmate complaining of excruciating increased pain from this cap. All they can say is, well, we gave him Tylenol two every 4 hours. And they gave that to anyone who asked for it, and is that effective treatment? In fact, if you look at the, I think it's the Sherrard versus Lingle case, they say, look it, or maybe it's the Chavez versus Cody case. When someone comes in with clear, obvious, subjective complaints that something's wrong, it can be deliberately indifferent to not simply ignore it, but to simply say, here, has a couple of aspirin, and go back to your cell. And that's essentially what they did here. That was not the type of conduct in response to an obvious medical problem here that rises, that satisfies their constitutional duty to Mr. Johnson to provide him a minimum adequate medical care, because they're his custodians.
Now, he's released on the 19th, right?
Well, he got himself out of that jail so he could seek medical treatment.
Well, whatever.
Right.
He left on the 19th. On the 13th, he does see a doctor, right?
Well, that's where the deliberate indifference begins. On the 13th, he has the ankle casted.
Yeah, and a doctor notes he asked for painkiller, right? I mean,
he asked the
doctor for painkiller.
You're talking about the orthopedic surgeon?
Yeah, Dr. Lane.
We have nothing in the record that would suggest that one way or another. Dr. Lane was not deposed before summary judgment was granted. His medical records themselves do not express whether or not the...
Does the records reflect the noted decrease in the swelling of the ankle?
Yes, and that's the only reason he would have applied that cast with the decrease. That's why it wasn't applied originally, mm-hmm. because you don't apply a cast to a swollen body part, because what happens is what happens here. Now, importantly, Dr. Lane did give a written instruction to the guard that accompanied Mr. Johnson to the jail, and that written instruction, which the jail attorney had, specifically told them, if there are any problems, contact me immediately. And I am emphasizing, that's what the doctor, he has it highlighted, in fact, the defendant attached it as one of their exhibits to their brief. And the law is very clear, by disregarding the instructions of treating physicians, jailers can be deliberately indifferent, that alone itself. I want to reserve some time for rebuttal, but I want to touch one issue because I feel it's so important. I do not want the court to lose sight of the fact that we have a negligence claim that was dismissed on a 12B6 motion by the judge that I think was absolutely wrong and has to be reversed. It was a negligence claim against these jailers because they were negligent in the manner in which they treated this individual. And the defendant, and it was dismissed based on the defendant's motion because the judge said, well, this really isn't a negligent treatment claim. This is really a negligent failure to obtain medical care. That's not how it was pled. It was very specific that these individuals were providing medical care to this inmate because only they could. And they were negligent in the manner in which they managed that by failing to pass on very pertinent information on an ongoing basis to the medical treaters. That should not have been dismissed. It did not fall within the 4105 provision of the Illinois Tort Immunity Act. And I'm going to leave
Well, we get the point, and I want to give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Kaysen.
Please, the court. My name is George Kaysen. I'm here representing the defendants, Sheriff of Woodford County, and the 10 correctional officers that are defendants here. I want to address one point, the question you, Your Honor, had for Mr. Kelly about what evidence there was with respect to the plaintiff asking for prescription pain medication from Dr. Lane on July 13th. The evidence of that is from Mr. Johnson's deposition testimony. He is the one who said that I complained to the doctor about the pain, about the swelling that I had, about the increase in pain, that I was concerned about the possibility of an infection, and the pain was so bad, so excruciating, that I needed a prescription pain medication. Tylenol wasn't working. That was the deposition testimony of Mr. Johnson, and that was his testimony with respect to every visit that he made to a doctor throughout that period. When he saw Dr. Cullinan the first time, when he saw Dr. Cullinan the second time, when he saw Dr. Lane the first time, and when he saw Dr. Lane the second time. He saw four doctors during that period. Each time he said to them, I need something more than Tylenol. The pain is excruciating. It's unbearable. The counsel's descriptions of this pain are a theme that is played by the plaintiff, Mr. Johnson, throughout this 21-day period. He was complaining about the severity of the pain from day one. And he was told by the doctors, and the doctors told the correctional officers, they are not going to prescribe anything more than Tylenol for him. The second point that I want to make is that plaintiff's counsel, as able as he is, and as well as he's argued here, is a misapprehension about what he needs to do on summary judgment. He has the opinion that he doesn't need to prove anything on summary judgment. In fact, he has the burden of coming forward with evidence, specific evidence, on each element of his case against each defendant. Now, he sued 11 individuals here. Every officer who he says had contact with him during the whole period that he was in the jail. He forgets that he admits in his reply brief that he doesn't have a case against the sheriff or Officer Griffenfrog, and that you can dismiss those. In fact, what he's done here is simply expand his complaint throughout this process, discovery and summary judgment, and simply repeat his allegations that everybody, every deputy, every officer, everyone I came in contact with, I complained to, and they did nothing. That is not sufficient on a motion for summary judgment. He has to come up with specific evidence as to each of these deputies. The deputy who saw him one day, the deputy who saw him for 2 days, the deputy who saw him for 4 days. But he hasn't done that. He has no specific evidence with respect to any of the deputies. The evidence that is in this case was the testimony of the deputies as to what happened, the documentation of what happened. And that evidence is overwhelming, Your Honors, that this man received extensive medical care throughout his stay in the jail. He complained that he had injured his ankle on June 28th. Immediately on that day, Officer Wirtz called the doctor, as he was supposed to do. He got instructions from the doctor of what they were to do. Give him Tylenol, put it on ice, have him elevated. They gave those instructions to Mr. Johnson. They gave him the Tylenol every day, several days thereafter. They followed the instruction. The nurse came the next day. The nurse examined. Mr. Johnson continued to complain about pain. Officer Wirtz called the doctor again, relayed the complaints to him. Officer Myers called the doctor, relayed Mr. Johnson's complaints to him. The doctor's instructions were always the same. Continue to give him Tylenol. I'll see him. Then the doctor comes in. Doctor examines him. Mr. Johnson complains to the doctor, I need more medicine. I need a painkiller. This is excruciating. Doctor says, no, you're just getting Tylenol. He orders an x-ray. The x-ray machine is brought to the jail. An x-ray is taken. They determine that the plaintiff has a fracture in the heel. So the defendants sent him to a specialist, an orthopedic specialist in Peoria. In the meantime, Mr. Johnson continues to complain about the pain. Again, the officers do what they're supposed to do. Regardless of the instructions they already have, they call the doctor again. Mr. Waterworth calls the doctor several times. Mr. Myers calls the doctor several times. Each time the doctor, Cullinan, says to them, no, I'm not going to give him anything stronger than Tylenol. Dr. Lane puts a splint on the on Mr. Johnson's foot. He comes back to the jail, complains again. The doctors call the officers call Dr. Cullinan. We're not going to give him anything more. Dr. Cullinan examines Mr. Johnson again in the jail. Mr. Johnson complains again about the pain. Again, the doctor continues instructions. Mr. Johnson is taken on July 13th to see Dr. Lane in Peoria. Dr. Lane says the swelling's gone down. We can apply the cast. See me in 5 weeks. Continue to take the Tylenol. Mr. Johnson comes back to the jail and complains again about the pain. The pain is worse with the cast. So, Mr. Officer Waterworth calls Dr. Cullen. Dr. Cullen says, nothing more, nothing other than Tylenol. That night, Dr. Johnson complains again. Officer Myers calls Dr. Cullen that night, and again the following day, same instructions. The point that Mr. Kelly makes about Dr. Cullen and not recalling those conversations is really immaterial, because it doesn't controvert what Mr. Waterworth and Mr. Myers recall. In fact, what they did is entirely consistent with what the admitted evidence says that they did throughout that period. The officers called Dr. Cullinan when they got complaints from Mr. Johnson, and the instructions they heard were the same throughout that period, yet they continued to call. What the question that Mr. Kelly asked Dr. Cullinan in his deposition was, do you recall a conversation where they told you about problems with the cast? And he couldn't recall that. That's a hypothetical. But he said he did. It was not unusual for the officers to call him many times about a patient such as Mr. Johnson, and that it wouldn't be unusual for him not to recall those. But, you know, given the way things were worked, Dr. Cullen said it was likely that they did call. Now, plaintiff has offered no controverting evidence at all with respect to those calls. The uncontroverted evidence is that these officers did exactly what they were supposed to do as laymen, and that is call the professional, tell him what the inmate is complaining about, and give the professional an opportunity to decide what to do, and the professional said, no change.
Well, on the question of whether anyone called the prison doctor after the cast was applied, it seems to me all we have is the deputy's equivocating statement, the doctor's lack of recall. We have the absence of a record of the calls, even though other calls were recorded. The deputy's doing something other than what the doctor says he would have told them to do, because he testified he would have told them to call the orthopedist. So what I'm wondering is how on summary judgment the court could conclude that the prison doctor had been called.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the deposition testimony of Officer Waterworth and Officer Myers was not equivocating. I think if you look at it, you'll find that Officer Myers, for example, was definite that he had called. And he called more than once. What he was a little uncertain about was when the first call was. But he was definite that he had made a call after Mr. Johnson had returned with the cast. As to Mr. Waterworth, he was a little uncertain as to the date. He knew he had called. He just couldn't recall at first whether it was on the 13th or the 14th. The more he thought about it, I think as you read his deposition testimony, he was more certain that he had called after the court, Mr. Johnson had the cast apply. Second, the rule at the policy at the jail was to write down on the prisoner's records no instructions from a doctor or when the instructions had changed. These instructions from Dr. Cullen were written down originally on June 28th, when the first received them from the doctor. There was no change in the instructions thereafter, so there was no need to write down any change. And that was a pattern that was followed throughout that period. Whenever, after that first call, although it's admitted that the deputies made several calls, they didn't write that down every time they made a call because the answer from Dr. Cullen was always the same. And it was the same thing that Dr. Cullen and Dr. Lane had said to Mr. Johnson. Your Honors, Counsel, Mr. Kelly makes the point of comparing this case to the Chavez case. I think that these are very different circumstances. For example, in Chavez, that was an instance where the plaintiff had appendicitis and was not seen by a doctor, did not go to the emergency room until 11 days after the onset of his pain. In this case, the day of the onset of Mr. Johnson's pain, the doctor was called. The doctor sent a nurse to examine him the following day. He received professional care on five different occasions, and received what the professionals considered full treatment. That is not the case in Chavez. Chavez was a situation where you had 11 days where an inmate with appendicitis did not get to see a doctor or taken to the emergency room. This is an entirely different case than Chavez. Your Honor, I think it's important, given the rule of the circuit about considering the totality of the medical care that is provided to a prisoner, that any complaint has to be considered in terms of all the care that was provided, not just the narrow complaint about what happened the last 6 days of his stay in the jail. And his reply brief, counsel refers to the case of Reed versus McBride as suggesting that is an application of the totality doctrine that is more appropriate here. Again, the Reed case involved a very seriously ill inmate who provided undisputed evidence that he was denied on numerous occasions his medication for several days at a time because of a simple bureaucratic blunder that when he came back from his treatment, his medical treatment, he couldn't get his identification badge for several days, and because he didn't have a badge, he couldn't get his medicine. And it's undisputed in that case that he complained to the defendants in writing, and they did nothing about it. That is a case where the totality was one of deliberate indifference. That's not the case here. The totality is of a situation where all of the officers did what they were supposed to do. They provided, they did what they could to obtain medical care for this plaintiff. Now, as to the negligence,
you can finish your thought.
As to the negligence claim, I think, Your Honor, you have to look at the statutes, the only statutes that are involved here. There is a Section 4105 of the Tort Immunity Act provides clear immunity to correctional officials for negligence in furnishing or providing medical care to a prisoner. Counsel is referring to a separate section of the Tort Immunity Act that does not apply to correctional officers. There is no law in the state of Illinois that applies Section 6106 to a case like this. If you're going to do so, you're going to create havoc in the state of Illinois.
Thank you, Ms. Catherine. Ms. Kelly.
Got a lot to cover in my limited time. Just real quick on that. 4106 is the basis he's asserting for immunity on the negligence count. That's the only thing you have to look at. Does that apply? And that applies specifically on its face to claims that they failed to obtain medical care from a medical professional. Here we're talking about a negligence claim that's pled, and we're just looking at the pleadings, that they failed in their management and care of providing medical care.
Wait, you're splitting a hair here. They're supposed to get it. They're not supposed to apply the cast.
Well, they give them Tylenol, they give them ice, they elevate the leg. Those are all part of medical care.
That's not exactly a doctor's position. And the parking lot's, Butch Ashman from the secretary doesn't mean she's giving medical care.
I agree. You're also not within their custodial care. He had no choice but
to.
Perhaps I spoke out of turn. I apologize. The point is this, is that we're not suggesting they rise to the level of doctors, but just as you have nurses that provide medical care, maybe not at the same level, they're dispensing.
They're medical professionals, nurses.
Well, here we have individuals who are taking care. They're
responsible to call in medical care.
Well, they're responsible for that part of medical care that transfers information, and that's all the allegation is, transferring pertinent, absolutely crucial medical care. Now, I want to jump back here to the other arguments counsel made. And the important thing here, does that mean I'm done?
It does, but I'm going to give you, as I gave an extra minute to Mr. Catherine, you have one too, Mr. Kelly.
I appreciate it. You have to remember we're dealing with summary judgment. We look at the evidence, and this is what Mr. Kasten does not do. This is what the judge does not do. You have to look at the evidence in a light most favorable to plaintiff. You have to look at the defendant's testimony in a light most favorable to plaintiff. You have to accept what plaintiff says is true. You do not weigh the relative credibility of the witnesses. Here we have to look at their evidence as to whether or not they transmitted information regarding his complaints of cast to a doctor in a light most favorable to plaintiff. In this case, on that standard, you cannot conclude as a matter of law that they did that. And even if you did, that still did not satisfy their obligation to make sure he received medical care within that 8-day period of time when they have absolutely no evidence. All that evidence he talked to you about everything they did was up to the 13th of July. He didn't mention anything after the 13th of July because there's no evidence that anything was done after it. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Thank you, Mr. Kasten. The case is